here once again with the great and mighty Jeffrey Ford, who is most recently the author of Crackpot Palace. Jeff, thanks so much for coming all the way out to Ohio just to see me. Or did you?
No, Ed, it's great to see you guys. 11-hour drive. Well, just to come into New York to see you at the B-Bar. That's what
I'm doing here. Well, very good. So I actually wanted to start off with something that's really interesting about, well, there's a number of things that are interesting, but there's one thing that I actually dwelled on, and that was the whole first-person mechanism in such stories as Down Atsian Road, 86 Death Dick Road, all the road stories, the double of my double is my double. You have a man who has a wife named Lynn,
right?
And you are a man with a wife named Lynn. I know that you have the portrait of Mrs. Sharbuk dedicated to a Lynn of some kind, who could be the real Lynn or this fictional Lynn. But I was curious about this particular eye, who's a little bit more violent and wants to kill people and shit. I don't think you necessarily harbor these desires, but you know, how did this eye come about and why do you keep returning to him? Does the Lynn within these stories serve as eyes muse or keep some sort of level-headed or calm?
Well, this is, it's really kind of a continuation of something I've done in earlier stories. I got interested in writing these kind of stories from reading Isaac Singer, Besheva Singer. He has these stories where when he comes to New York and he's living in New York, and they're from the first-person point of view. It could be his life. I mean, you can tell that he knows this world that he's writing about, and the protagonist is a writer. His name's never really mentioned a lot of times. But I thought, oh, that's such a cool idea, because what he can do, and I can tell he's doing this, he's fusing what he sees in his real life with these elements of, and a lot of these stories are supernatural.
Yeah.
So it's like he convinces the reader of the reality of the world because he's got the details at his disposal from having lived them. And then it starts to do that slow, 19th century supernatural creep where the fantastic infuses itself into the story. And I started writing these, I guess, pretty early on. And I continue. I don't do as many of them now as I used to, I did them exclusively for a while. But it's really, they have elements of autobiography.
Yeah.
And Lynn is my wife's name. But it's like, we're never really the people we really are, I don't think. But there are aspects of our lives in those characters, you know. And so... I could actually do a collection now of a full collection of stories. Just
Jeffrey Ford
with me me and a character named Lynn my kids and that kind of stuff. I've been doing those. I enjoy doing them, and it gives me a kind of a platform to get into some of the other stuff that I want to get into.
Yeah,
and then sometimes I don't bother with it. I kind of stayed away from them for a couple of years. These stories crop up occasionally, up occasionally. So that's where it came from.
Why do you stayed away from them, even though they were
You know, the thing is, it almost became like I wanted to get away from it because it almost became like a, I was doing it too often.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do different stuff. That's really what this whole book is about, even though it has some of those stories. They're different than the earlier ones.
Yeah.
They're less sentimental, these stories. They're much less have an emotional base to them, And I was doing stories that I knew I could do and I knew I could be successful with. But it's like, how many times am I going to write that story,
Yeah.
So these stories, I had an idea where I wanted to make them slightly busted, slightly, more twisted. The ending's not so satisfactory,
And I know that have a little bit of a broken element to them in order for them to...
It's taken a big chance because Reed is like, hey, this story's fucking busted, you know what I mean? So the challenge was, how can you do that and still make the story interesting to read, for somebody, to change it up. But I always keep changing and have different styles in there and different types of stories, because otherwise it just gets boring. I mean, it's not like I'm making $1 million doing this.
Yeah.
I want to pursue the idea of fiction writing, and so, I want to pursue it in all its different forms and so forth. I mean, I don't look askance at any type of fiction writing, romance writing, westerns, whatever you want. Let's see what's in there, what can be done with it,
You're not defined by genre when you set out to actually create a story.
No, I mean, the genre thing is, I know most of the stories lean, toward the fantastic, which is something I really, I enjoy. But I wrote a lot of stories earlier and, when I started out, there were more realistic stories.
Yeah.
I have done mysteries and science fiction and fantasy and stuff like that. whatever, it's really what's the story. And then when I write the story, sometimes I look around and find the market that it might fit. Or sometimes an editor will give me, all right, like I work a lot with Ellen Datlow, and she says to me, write a YA vampire story.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, come on, man, that's fucking so beat, you know?
Yeah. but that's a challenge.
But then it's a challenge. And then I like, all right, and then I, in the book, I talk about this a little in the notes. I saw it, Let the Right One In, when that came out. And I was like, man, that's, this guy took that vampire thing, which is just about flayed at this point, and did something brand new with it, Can you do that? That's a challenge. Can you do that? That always interests me, that kind of challenge. Like, something that I think would be, like, what's the stalest thing you could think of? How could you make it interesting,
Yeah.
I like that.
So, but on the other hand, you had to be persuaded to actually write that story by Datlow. So my question, though, is, like...
That's true.
But on the other hand, there is, to my mind, a sort of... unfettered surrealistic quality to a lot of the stories, especially the ones that are rooted in dreams and so forth, the wallpaper story and so forth.
Yeah.
So, I'm wondering how limitations compare against the sort of the unfettered dream that comes to your mind that you say, that's going to be perfect for something I can actually turn into a story to make sense of, much in the same way as you make sense of the Jeff of the real and the Jeff and Lynn in the actual story.
Well, I'm not quite sure this is going to answer that, but I mean, that story that you're talking about, the heaven and hell wallpaper story, that thing actually just happened to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I had those dreams, I had that experience, and I remembered it, and they all seemed to coalesce to get in, have this kind of theme to them.
Yeah.
So I just wrote it down, and I thought to myself, it's a different kind of structure than what a story would have, but it's kind of an interesting thing, the way it connects in a way. So I wanted to try that. I mean, I do a lot of stuff like that. I guess you would call it like an experiment. I hate to use the word experimental because I'm not, a scientist. But I wanted to try and see what it would come out like. And I was doing a story to send to that Interfictions, which is this kind of, interstitial kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which I'm not really quite sure what that is now anyway. But
I thought sign me up. I'll figure out the genre
my
later.
My feeling was this is really fucking wacky. I think that's what they're looking for. But that's probably the truest story in the book. You know what I mean? Like the actual, that's what actually happened. There are limitations though to that, to the surreal, in that if it becomes too pervasive in the story and there's no grounding for the reader, then I don't think it has an effect. It can't be an effect. That's one of the reasons why I like the autobiographical stuff, because I can ground it in a sense of reality before it takes off into a. So you have some kind of grounding to stand on to read the rest of the story, and for it to have an effect on you, otherwise, you can have stuff that's completely surreal. Anything you make, just pick words out of the dictionary and string them together, but it's not going to be very appealing. I mean, your story, you still need characters, you still need a plot, But and the thing is that in reality, a good story, well told in a traditional format, nothing beats it. When it's really well done, you know what I mean? Nothing could top it.
Yeah.
Like, take a story by Alice Munro or somebody like that. I mean, you could have all the kind of pyrotechnics you want, and she's just writing this kind of, like, realism, that she does.
Yeah.
And a lot of her stories are more, could be more powerful than any kind of, like, craziness that you could dream up, So you have to balance that. And, sometimes you fall off the tightrope one way, sometimes you fall off the other way.
Well, what's the maximum amount of surrealism threshold that we can actually have, that you can actually have in a story? I mean, I think of the last story, the Daddy Longlegs story, where you got a spider coming in and burrowing his way into a brain.
That's not even close to the limit.
No, of course. But, we're talking about rooting something in reality, and when you're dealing with the phantasmagorical, how do you rein yourself in to make it work within this kind
of
real
template? What I thought about with that story, what I was really trying to affect, I had kind of two influences. One was, like the Fleischer Brothers cartoons.
Yes.
And if you ever see the work of, like, Kim Deitch, his cartoons. Like, that was one influence. And I thought if I could bring that to life in a story, and tell a story and that convey that kind of a world, and, it would be kind of cool, And there's a story by Robert Coover that's a takeoff on the Pied Piper. It's in his childhood book that came out from, McSweeney's?
Yeah.
And it's a very dark, very kind of, in a way, kind of cartoonish piece, but it's very, very powerful and, you know, really really dark, you know?
Yeah.
I was like, that's really cool, like, to get the cartoon and the dark, like, really mixed together. So that's what I had in mind when I went into that. And then I don't know if you just read this the other day, they found some woman who had a spider, like, had burrowed into her ear.
No,
did you read about this?
No, I did not hear about
this.
Yeah,
it was on CNN or something.
Oh, wow. Wow. So, you know, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction, of course.
Well, in the notes to that story, I talk about it. I went up to Stone Coast, and I was doing a reading up there at the MFA program in Maine. And Jim Kelly said to me later, he said, I had a student who said to me about that story, can he do that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Are you allowed to do that?
But do you ask yourself that question?
Well, you do ask yourself that question at certain times, you know. The way when you ask it is usually before you start. Because once you get into it, then one thing leads to the next, and you're not asking that question anymore. You're just asking what's next. Where's it going?
You can't have limits to push forward. You know, yeah, you need to actually keep going.
Yeah, but yeah, you ask that question. I ask that question occasionally. Can I do this? Number one, I ask it: am I capable of doing it? And number two is, you know, not so much can I do it, but is it just like masturbating, or is like a reader going to like it? You know what I mean? Is some reader going to find something in this that's worthwhile? Because that's who I'm writing for. Otherwise, I'll stay home and write in my diary. You know what I mean? And write in therapy then. It's not,
yeah.
You
know? Well, I mean, that leads me to ask you, how many aborted stories do you have that work into this regrettable masturbation mode of storytelling that are sort of in the kind of secret diaries, files that will be burned upon my death?
Well, listen, I'm sure there are people who would say there were more than I thought there were. But, yeah, I mean, you know... Well, what happens sometimes, too, is you want to get something going, and you think you got something going somewhere, and you'll start a piece, and you'll realize that's what it is, and you shelve it. But the thing, what happens is, I never throw anything out, you know? I got a drawer full of masturbation stories, of these stories. You go through that stuff sometimes, and then you can see where the path opens up, and it becomes a real story then, you know?
Yeah.
And so you just keep the stuff around, and... At some point, it becomes clear to you that this will work if you do this, if you make it a real story, you know, and you still keep going in this direction with it, you know.
Sure.
It's all not a science. I mean, you know, you make the most of what you have there and see what you can do with it.
Yeah.
And you have to feel, it has to feel right to you, too, you know, when you put the next foot down, you have to feel right about it.
Yeah.
So.
I wanted to actually talk about the story called The Seventh Expression of the Robot General. It gets into the absurdity of war hero worship. It's actually a pretty funny story that becomes just a wow, really, that's how they view this robot. You write in the accompanying note, I'm still not exactly sure why the U.S. became embroiled in a war with Iraq. But we also see war in a number of the other stories. There's Father Walter Sermon in Relic. He outlines having to kill someone. I was curious to ask you about why war is such a draw for you, and how, you know, I presume you don't have any direct combat experience or anything.
No.
So how do you understand what it is to kill someone? Is it this matter of just really not understanding exactly sure why?
Well, you know what the thing is, if you think about it, I mean, it's not really that much of a draw for me in my writing. I mean, there were those two stories.
Yeah.
The one, the Relic one, is, came to me. I was reading a book called, you know, I can't remember the dude's name now. It's in there.
Yeah.
It's a terrific book. I mean, it's a book about World War II, and there's a scene in it that I basically lifted and put in this, you know, and put it in my own way in there, you know.
The ultimate way to get it right.
Well, there was that. But the other thing with the Robot General, it's not so much about war that I'm trying to emulate or get the idea about what it is to be in combat, because I can't know it. I was just talking about this with my friend the other night. You know, some of our students we used to have were, you know, combat veterans, and here they are. They're like 19 years old. They were over in, you know, Iraq or Afghanistan or something like that. And we were just saying we have no concept of what are they bringing? Or what do we know about that? Nothing.
Yeah.
So it's not so much that I want to do that in the Robot General, but what I want to do is give the sense of what it seems like to somebody who's here, who's living in this country. And how, you know, ridiculous it seems, and how absurd it seems and surreal. I mean, that and then the story of the Drowned Life in my last collection.
Yeah.
They were both a response to, you know, the Bush administration and the absurdity of it and, you know, the money being spent and the lives being lost. And I still don't know what the hell we're doing there.
Yeah.
You know, what we were there. It was just 10 years now.
Yeah.
And now we're droning people. Don't drone me, bro, as Nick Mamata says.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I still don't know. It's absurd. But we live our lives. And I never see news on CNN about the war, hardly ever, except for if somebody gets blown up, you know, or the Brigadier General, I think, got blown up the other day, you know, so they had that. But you never see photo. You never see video of it. It's always like pictures. There's a picture of the map with a big blow up and the guy's face is next to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's a very strange thing. And I think this country, if you ask people about, you know, Afghanistan, they have no fucking idea what's going on over there, just like I don't. And we're dumping tons of billions of dollars into this and the economy blows here. Now, do we have a commitment to the people there? Maybe that's why they're doing it. The droning thing I have. That's really bizarre.
Yeah.
You know? Death from the skies.
Yeah.
And with a lot of collateral damage. We're talking about kids and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And so you have this sense of Obama as being this guy who's like a family man with daughters and all that. Now, is he doing that to save American troops' lives? Maybe that's why. And he's just made this moral decision, like, that's what I'm going to do. But that doesn't really wash either, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And so you have that. This is the kind of thing I was trying to get across in that. So it's comic, in a way, when you think about this shit. It's really kind of funny because it's so ironic, you know, that you'd have no idea, but you're spending all this money and you're killing people.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, it's surreal. It's bizarre. And so, you know, I mean, Rumsfeld was definitely my inspiration for the Robot General.
Yes. Well, here's the thing.
I also wanted to ingratiate myself to Hawks and Republicans, you know what I mean?
Sure. But here's the thing. I'm wondering, you know, how can fiction tell us about these unknowable sensations that stretch beyond the territory of what an embedded journalist can actually cover, go within that terrain? I mean, we're essentially imagining and, I guess, hypothesizing about what that sheer brutality or violence is likely to be. You know, is the kind of speculation in fiction better than, say, the speculation by, you know, preopic op-ed types or whatever? Or?
I don't think it's... I mean, I listen to, you know, I hear... Terry Gross has a lot of reporting, had a lot of reporting on from people who had actually been in, like, Fallujah and places like that, you know? And their descriptions of this stuff really are, you know, really terrifying to me. I can't imagine. I got a 19-year-old kid that I'd be just standing there, stone, stock, scared, shitting my pants. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You got these 19-year-old kids, 18-year-old kids who are acting. They're doing what they have to do, you know?
Yeah.
Which I don't know how they do it. So you hear that kind of, you hear about those things, the reality of them. That's one thing, right? You can approximate things, though. I mean, I remember reading this piece by Hemingway. He was talking about going to the Sherwood Anderson. He was hanging out with Sherwood Anderson, and Anderson had never been to a racetrack or anything. He didn't really know anything about horses, but he described this guy falling off his horse backwards in one of his stories. And, you know, he had never seen anything like this happen before. And he and Hemingway were at the racetrack the next day or a couple days later after they were talking about this. And the guy, that actually happened. And they saw it, and Hemingway said it happened exactly the way that he wrote it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think to an extent you're able to imagine those things because you're a human being, you're in those kind of situations. There are instances in there, moments, though, like when... You would think something would be the way it is, you know, the way that you imagine it, but it's probably the opposite.
Yeah.
So you have a situation like, I read a story once by Graham Joyce, a British writer, and, you know, he had these two fathers, and one father was kind of abusing his kid, and the other father was getting mad at him and went over to him. Now, most writers would take that and have it like some kind of corny screaming match. But he didn't do that. He did this kind of, this low-key conversation that was full of, like, menace, but really controlled, you know what I mean? And that's the way it really would have happened. But most people would have gone for the, you know, oh, this is obviously going to be to turn into a fight or, like, you know, fisticuffs and stuff. But I've seen that happen before, and it's not what you would first go for. It's, you know, something else entirely. I don't know if that makes any sense, but...
No, I mean, I think what we're talking about is how the fiction writer saturates herself into speculation, and enough speculation with which to offer, I suppose, a plausible narrative incident that in some strange way mimics what could happen in reality or actually even anticipates it. You know, what do you do? I mean, have there been instances where you've had a moment that, you know, oh man, this, I'm really embarrassed for having gotten something wrong, or do you even care about something like this?
Well, you know, I have moments where I come to that, like, you know, in 86 Death Dick Road, right?
Yes.
We're talking about, like, one of the most basic human things that most people will not cop to.
Yeah.
Jealousy, right? Fears of inadequacy and so forth. These are not topics that I would bring up, talk about myself with in a pleasant conversation. But when you come to this stuff in the story, that's where you have to make your decision, like, am I going to go for it? Is it, you know, because you know if you don't, the story's going to suck.
Yeah.
But if you can do it and pull it off, you'll say those things that most people aren't going to say. And that'll make the story interesting, I think, and come to life, you know?
Yeah.
And there is a period, some place sometimes where you have to ask that question yourself, can I do this? And then more times than not, I'm like, you know what? I've learned to appreciate those instances and then push through them. And then, you know, I think that's really the way to go. Because otherwise, what's the fucking point?
Yeah.
You know?
But it's interesting that you bring that story up, because I like that story. It's one of my favorites, actually, in the collection. But that story is also operating in a weird way in this kind of forgotten 20th century mode to some extent. You're going for a drive. You're trying to find a place. You've got a piece of paper. And then, of course, you know, you assume that the person's going to be the smartest man in the world. And I was reading this going, you know, this is really cool. These are the kinds of stories I used to read all the time, and I'm not going to get, because now you can Google all this, or now you can actually go ahead and whip out Google Maps on your iPhone. And I wanted to ask you, you know, like, to the degree to which you can actually write a story like that, that is in that kind of older mode, that analog mode, in an age where people are so bombarded with information so that it just totally takes away the mystery or the intrigue or the idea of believing that someone could be what they are. How do fiction writers counter this? Or do you just not care? You just write whatever you feel like?
Well, you know what the thing is? With the smartest man in the world, it doesn't really matter, because he never really says anything that's all that smart. You know, he just basically knows.
Well, yeah.
You know,
so
and the questions they're asking him aren't anything you have to look up on Google. It's like, you know, he tells people, you know, like, they're asking him personal questions about their lives, really. It becomes like a psychic in a way, you know? So I escape it in that kind of matter. But I remember one of the things that cracked me up about that story was when it came out, there were two reviews of that book that it came, a very small book with a couple of stories by, like, Shepard and Silverberg and a couple of, but both reviewers were like, well, you know, Jeff Ford has a story in here, but this book was called Book of Dreams.
Yeah.
But they're saying it's not like a dream.
Yeah.
I was like, why isn't it? I think it is a dream. I mean, that's the way my dreams are. They're really based in reality. You know,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that also raises an interesting point, because I was, like, poking around the internet to see if anybody had written about the book, as I usually do. And there was one guy who I saw was actually giving you shit, because he's saying...
Oh, about this one?
About this one.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, he's basically saying, well, you know, it's a little difficult to come to terms with some of these stories because I'm not certain how they actually apply to the genre. As if it was this kind of, like, you know, codex that you had to actually hit certain motifs in order to actually be a true genre story.
Well, that's a big problem, because and it's almost like if you don't have any frame for something like that, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think that that's true to a large extent. I knew that that would be an issue with these with these pieces, but what can I do about it? But that's true. I mean, this has been since I started. I mean, where does this fit? They're more concerned with where it fits than what the actual story is about, you know? Which is, I guess, you know, that's something that some writers probably take into consideration.
Yeah.
And some, well, I don't, you know.
Well, on the other hand, at the end of Dr. Lash Remembers, you do have the disclaimer about steampunk. You say,
well, I know, but I'm kidding.
You say, my steampunk stories are steampunk, whether the reviewers know it or not. So, you know,
But what I'm saying there is, like, I'm all about the steam. Like, steampunk to me is like a room full of old furniture. It's all this, like, you know, it's anachronistic technology. So everybody writes steampunk stories that are about these big, stupid old machines and stuff, which I think it's kind of a bore.
Yeah.
But I'm about the fucking steam. That's where my steampunk comes in.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So that's what I say in there. You know?
Sure.
Steam is the new dream.
My point, though, Jeff, my point is this. You know, why should the genres have to come around to you? And why should you be even... even having to defend yourself in relation to steampunk, because is steampunk even going to be around in like five or ten years?
I did that as a joke, basically, that piece in there. You know, it was kind of a joke, because I've done a couple of those stories.
Yeah.
And every time I do one, somebody says, well, you might even say, I like the story, but it's not steampunk. It always cracks me up, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, should people come around to them? I guess they don't have to. I mean, you know, but as far as I know as a reader, I'm not looking for, if I'm not going to find books that do give me the same experience every time. I mean, I'm looking to find books that have an idiosyncratic voice and a different way of looking at the world.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the way I approach literature. A lot of people don't approach literature that way.
I know.
And it's, but it's not, you know, that's their thing. That's what they're interested in.
Yeah.
But that's what I do. I mean, it's not going to get you the biggest audience. I think, and there are writers who are very inventive and idiosyncratic who do get a big audience, but not a lot of them. A lot of times it's much more formulaic, but that's what people like to read. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, you know what I mean? It's not hurting anybody.
but to a certain degree, you could argue that the idea of having to adhere to formula is, in fact, going to affect your ability to write something idiosyncratic or original on page. And I'm with you. I'm also an omnivorous reader. I don't give a damn if it's mystery, chick lit, science fiction. It just has to be good.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as a writer, especially working fantasy and science fiction, and those guys are like, probably have more subgenres than some sort of electronic music connoisseur, right? You know, how are there certain areas that are off limits to you because people expect you to adhere to certain formula?
Well, they're not. Well, the thing is that they're not off limits to you. I mean, you can do them. You may not have great success in selling them, you know.
Yeah.
But I've never really had a problem selling stuff. You know, I mean, it's not like it appears every time where I exactly want it to.
Yeah.
But I've never had a problem. I don't think I've written a story that I haven't sold in, like, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years. You know what I mean? So it's not a problem. You just can't expect, you know, the thing is, you can't write, this is what it comes down to with a book like this. You can't write a book like this, or you can't write stuff that's idiosyncratic and, you know, kind of like your original take on fiction and so forth, and expect everybody to like it. See, people write this stuff. I know a lot of guys who are writing surreal stuff and all that, and they're so fucking pissed off because not everybody, you know, is like falling over.
But,
so it's like, you want to write something that's on the outside, then you got to expect that that's the readership you're going to get. You know what I mean?
And that's something that's actually an issue that has nothing to do with the genre.
If you have the correct expectation,
yes,
then, you know, everybody's happy. You know what I mean?
So, I mean, audience then for you is really not an issue, or?
I like it. I mean, I hear from people, you know, readers write to me, and I'll get somebody will drop me a note that they like the story or they like the book, you know. And it's a very wide, divergent bunch of people, you know. So I can't quantify it. I can't really put my finger on what would a Jeff Ford reader be, you know, or anything. And I'm happy about that. That's good. I mean, I really don't know what to think. Keeping the reader in mind, I'm the reader, basically, you know. So I basically write in these stories that I hope people like, and I think they will, and they'll get a kick out of, and there's a lot of humor in them that I think people will get, you know. So I try to do the best I can, but I'm not fooling myself that this is going to be like on the Times bestseller list.
Yeah. I wanted to actually ask you about After Moreau, which is also just a comic story, but it's also written in response to something that is a major cultural touchstone. And I'm wondering, you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, to what degree stories sort of serve as cultural responses in some sense, or at least I was going to ask you about this. And I'm wondering, you know, why did you feel the need with this story to sort of, you know, was it just a matter of fun? Was it just a matter of, like, reinventing something you were familiar with? Was it a matter of homage, or was it a matter of, you know, what? What was the motivation for that?
Well, this cup. It was about, you know, about having fun with the idea of Moreau, and you know, I have those ideas a lot about, and I let them go. I mean, they don't really develop into anything, but this one kind of took off in my mind, and I'm a big fan of that movie, The Island of Lost Souls, with Lawton. I think it's the only movie ever directed or something, or is that right? No.
No.
He directed Night of the Hunter.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he stars in it, and he's Moreau, and he's just, like, phenomenal in that movie and does some really unusual stuff, you know? So I just I researching the background of that movie, I mean, you find out it's like Brigham Young's grandson.
Yes.
Just scripted, you know, Todd Browning, the guy who wrote for Todd Browning, who was, Philip Wiley or somebody is in it or something, you know. It's an interesting background. Not that played in the story, but it was a chance to take off in that world and that idea, those ideas of genetics and, you know, animals and people and stuff. I didn't really know about that one, Ed.
Yeah. Okay, well, let me ask you about something. We were talking about stories that emerge from dreams, but I also wanted to ask you about stories that were rooted in location, such as the Glass Eel story, which is in New Jersey Noir. 86 Death Dick Row, which we were talking about, you know, that's almost your response to the idea that suburbia is a bland wasteland. You know, a number of these stories, in counterbalance to the war between heaven and hell wallpaper, which is absolutely a dream. I'm wondering, you know, to what degree does the vividness differ when you're drawing upon location as opposed to dreams? And does one often inform the other? If you have, like, oh, I've got a location, maybe I need some surreal elements to fill in the details, well, and vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, like the Glass Eel story is really about location.
Yeah.
I mean, when I got the offer to do a story for that book, I went down there. And my buddy lives down. That's who I'm going to visit after New York. But I went down there to the end of Jersey. And down there, it's like a different world. I mean, it's really nothing like you would picture. I mean, there's towns down there like Shell Pile. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's out there. And it's got this kind of sentient feeling to it. A lot of South Jersey, like the Pine Barrens, is like this too, you know? And so, the location plays a big part in that. And it's a story that takes place in nature, really. And the Glass Eels are a real thing.
Yeah.
And there were these wars going on down there. Not wars, but these gun battles between people over these Glass Eels, because there's so much money to be made, you know? So I thought that... Can I have another one?
Yeah.
Thanks. But I thought that would be a good setting. When Oates read the story, she thought the Glass Eels thing were surreal, like a surreal element.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I thought was interesting, because it's so Jersey. I mean, there are things that happen in Jersey that are real, that are always seem like that. You know what I mean? That's indicative of New Jersey, I think, you know, if you know it well enough. But, location in that one. The location in the Pine Barrens one, you know, with down Atsian Road and the other one, they play a big part. And we talked about this, I remember last time, about the shadow year with location. It seems to be something that really interests me and grounds me in the story, you know. I can draw the details from it and draw the story out of it, out of a location like that.
But are you ever too grounded by location for these?
Well, I think so, because I remember with the shadow year, my editor was saying, you know, all right, we know where they are. You know what I mean? You got to cut some of this stuff out, you know, which was true. I mean, it kind of like, it gave you a great idea of like what the block looked like, but it's like you never could get off it. You know what?
Yeah.
So you have to leaven it a little, but yeah, you got to be careful.
Oh, yeah. I actually have to ask you about The Wish Head, the only story that you wrote specifically for this collection that has no notes. So yes. I'm going to ask you for an explanation for how that came to be. I mean, did you have any sort of interest in facial spasms or anything, or the soul shield pad stuff or whatever?
No. You know what the thing is? I figured, well, there's no note for that one because, I don't know, I just decided to leave it mysterious. I did write one on my you know, online thing.
Yeah.
And what I would have written if I wrote a note was, when I wrote that story, it's about a coroner.
Yeah.
And I was reading about coroners. I did a lot of research on it. But then, like, I wanted to talk to one. And my wife hooked me up, you know, with this guy who's a coroner, and one of them in South Jersey. He's a great guy. Really nice guy. Was very helpful. And we went to lunch at this seafood place down by this. But the whole time we were there, there was a fly flying around him. And it became, like, disconcerting to me.
Yeah.
Because, you know what I mean? It was buzzing. And at one point, it was, like, going around his head like a halo. You know what I mean? So I guess that's what would have been my note for that story.
Yeah.
But he told me a lot about it. It was very, very fascinating stuff, in the fact that, you know, to be a coroner, you don't really need any kind of, like, credentials at all in anything, medicine or anything. You know what I mean? As different than a medical examiner. And there were a lot of these guys, you know, working in these places like in upstate New York and at the time period that the story takes place. So,
yeah
it's great. And you know what else influenced that story was the a story in France where this woman, this woman drowns and they find her body in the Seine. And you know this thing? It's a beauty, this beautiful body, they find this woman. And she becomes this cause celeb among the poets and stuff. And they make a death mask of her face. And they write Cocteau and all those guys write poetry about it, I guess. And what happens is, what's really cool about it is the face is used then on the Ressusa Annie,
yeah.
The original one that's made in France, and also became the face of the one in America too. So what would happen was, all throughout time, this woman would be trying, people would be trying to resuscitate this woman who had been found in the river drowned. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's true. So that kind of interested me too. That was kind of an influence on the piece.
The thing that's been very interesting about this collection is the fact that, well, it's you are inspired by esoteric folklore, paintings, certain dreams that turn into something else that drive you to research another thing. I had no idea you were such an owl enthusiast, although that totally makes sense. You know, I'm wondering if there are any areas of knowledge where you tried to write a story, but it just didn't take.
Yeah. I mean, I still may go back and work on this.
Yeah.
But I did a lot of work on a book, on a novel about the Dust Bowl.
Yeah.
You know, and to me, it's a fascinating time period. And the stuff that would go on, I mean, during these dust storms, if you touch somebody, you're going to get blown across the room from the static electricity and all kinds of crazy shit. I mean, you know, these plagues of centipedes and everything would come. So I thought, this is cool. And not only that, but I thought to myself, what a resonance with these days as far as the, you know, the ecological disaster and the drought going on. But when I started, I was thinking about the Gulf spill and the oil spill in the Gulf, this huge man-made problem, you know, and that's what the Dust Bowl was. It was man-made.
Yeah.
And like they said, like 3/4 of the topsoil of the United States wound up in like the Gulf of Mexico or out, you know, blown out to sea from these people trying to grow wheat, you know, capitalize on these wheat prices and stuff. So I thought, all right, this kind of connects to the time period and it's good. But man, I got about 50, 60 pages into it and it was racking my brain. I just couldn't make it work.
What was it about the Dust Bowl that sort of broke your brain here?
It wasn't so much the Dust Bowl. I was like, this is like you were talking about the location thing.
Yeah.
I had the Dust Bowl down. But if the book could just be about the fucking Dust Bowl, about the dust, I got it.
Yeah.
But you have to have characters doing something. I couldn't figure out what the hell they were going to do, and that was the problem.
Pretty much, in your research and your reading, a lot of the people who were living dry lives, so to speak.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like, how are you going to go about making this a story, you know, and get the people in there and stuff? I don't know. I didn't know how to do it. So I got it still, you know, maybe I'll go back to it. But I still think it's a good idea. We'll see what happens. Somebody's going to do it. Somebody will do it, make it successful.
Karen Russell's actually working on a Dust Bowl novel.
See, I knew it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's...
I think there's room for more than one Dust Bowl novel.
No, there's another... Somebody else is working on a Dust Bowl novel.
There was a writer I know. I won't say who it is, but he's well known, you know.
Yeah.
And he said... I was telling him this, and he said, you know what, I was working on a Dust Bowl novel, and I couldn't finish it. I said, what'd you do? He said, I broke it down into two stories and sold them. You know what I
mean? Yeah.
You know, everybody's got their Dust Bowl novel in somewhere.
Yeah. It should be a Dust Bowl anthology.
That'd
you get a bunch of writers who try to write their Dust Bowl stories, or try to write a Dust Bowl novels, and here are the results of the 50 pages. I don't know.
That would be great.
Yeah. Well, on that note, Jeff... Thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you yet again.
Ed, I appreciate it so much. Thanks a lot.
Fantastic.
Thanks for seeing you guys.
Absolutely.